Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back our pal Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. He is, he's renowned. He is prolific. He has written several books, the most recent of which is The Sun's Heartbeat on Little Brown. And he has a new one, Mysterious. He won't say much about it, but it's coming. It's coming. And always nice to have Bob here in the studio. Get in line early. It tends to get pretty crowded toward the end. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Now, there are myriad ways you can contact us. And heaven knows, I don't have to keep track of them, so feel free to use them. You can post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And then you can call us. And that's 800-348-2551. That's the telephone number. Bob Berman is here. Bob, I send you links every now and then, and then I forget them. And a few weeks ago, I sent you one that said, "We are all Martians now," or something to that effect. What did that mean?
Well, the planet Mars may have been the origin of life on Earth. This is an old idea. I actually had that in one of my first books in the 90s, and I thought it was such a clever line. If that's true, we are all Martians. I thought that was so cool. And now that very line's being repeated again, and that makes any author go, grrr.
So this irritates you. This is theft.
Well, because they're not crediting.
They're not
saying, it's not an ego thing. It's just you want to say, as Bob Berman said in the book Secrets of the Night Sky, but okay, I have to get over that. And we might, the bottom line is, it's not a new idea. Nobody is sure about the origins of life on Earth. It started in the oceans, but what if, when Mars cooled first, which it did, life started there? Maybe panspermia is real, which means that life could have been transported there from elsewhere in the universe aboard asteroids or comets. In any case, got blasted into space from a meteor impact on Mars, eventually landed in Earth's oceans, took off, there's evolution. And here we are. We've evolved all the way to rats and sitcoms and all the things that we mammals do.
Rats and sitcoms. Now, there were some specifics in this article, some specific elements or something or other that was unique to Mars that was not here in the early stages of this planet's development.
Right. Because it cooled first, some think that the conditions were more favorable there than here, and therefore life did start there. And that's a cool idea. We're Martians. You know, that's kind of catchy.
All right, fair enough. And then the other thing I sent you, which I do remember because I sent it today, was an article on our own website, which was, "Be on the lookout for flashes in the sky." What's all that about?
Well, people love flashes in the sky.
Right.
You know, there's a fireball, which means a meteor as bright as Venus. By the way, Venus is coming back. The bright star that's seen after sunset in the direction of sunset, that's Venus. It's going to get brighter and higher in the months to come, really be bright around Christmas in January and February. But any meteor that bright or brighter is a fireball, and they happen several times a year over every location. And if you see one, you love it, and people call police stations, observatories, the UFO people think they're UFOs.
Sure, well, this was blue, I guess, the one the other night. Yes?
And they come in all colors. It all depends on what's the chemistry involved. You can also have used...
This was cobalt or something? Why was it blue?
Yeah, very good. I love it. Love being here with you because you really know these things. You remember all these things from school.
I work in radio. I know lots of stuff.
Yeah. And if there was copper in it, that could make it...
Orange. Green.
Green.
Yes,
right.
Or something. Whatever, Bob. It's a test now.
Okay, so in any case, you get all these colors. You could also have rocket stages that are disintegrating and flashes in the sky. That's cool. And people call up, of course, from time to time with them. And then there is another kind of thing that flashes, the Iridium constellation of satellites. It was back in the days when... You know, we wanted communications, and people had to have giant cell phone-looking things that were about 2 feet across and looked like giant bricks. And the Iridium company launched a constellation of, I think, something like 24 satellites. I don't remember how many. And they have giant solar panels, so when they catch the light, all of a sudden in the night sky, there'll be a brilliant blazing spot of light for a few seconds, and people go, whoa, what's that? And you can actually go online, and they will calculate for you. You give your location, it'll calculate when and where in the sky you'll see the next Iridium satellite flash. So those are flashes, too.
I have a great app, and I think it's called Skyview. And so, you know, you take it out, you can see what stars you're looking at, and it'll also show the satellites. And we're up in Maine and looking at the stars, and there was a very bright, I thought it was just a plane, and we were looking at stars in the area, and it showed all of a sudden it was the International Space Station. And boy, since then, we've seen it several times. It goes over a lot. It's so bright, it looked just like a plane to me.
Yeah, that's great. That's great to see it. And now, of course, as more and more parts have been assembled and the big panels, it is bright. It's great. And it's something nice about knowing that there are people up there all the time, even if very few of us can name exactly what they're doing.
Yes. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman, as you may have guessed, is our guest. Let's go to Sheldon and Troy. Sheldon, you're on.
Okay, Mr. Berman, I've been on the web and I've seen what is called the cosmic web of all the galaxies, and as extrapolated to what it would look like, seen from far away. It looks like almost like organic tissue. And I didn't know if anybody's speculating on the universe could be like in nesting levels, like Matryoshka dolls, like we could be inside of a being, and that being could be in another universe on a different, higher level. And then, of course, and that could be another level among that. Is anybody speculating in this possibility at all?
Well, you know there's been speculation. For example, the end of the movie Men in Black showed the aliens playing with marbles.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The marbles in the bag were our universe,
marbles. Right.
And, you know, the idea that everything we can see, the observable universe, which, by the way, we can look in 46 billion light years in each direction. That's the limit.
And see 0% of it.
Yeah,
perhaps.
It's about 0% of the larger universe beyond that. But even the visible universe, what if all of that is just an atom on a toothpick next to a sandwich in a delicatessen of the next larger universe? You know, so you can speculate. The problem is that the next universe beyond ours, that is beyond the observable one, we know nothing about. We can know nothing about because light never gets here. So that means all bets are off, and we can speculate, but can't know anything.
Well, how about the configuration of the galaxies? Does that actually remind anything of anything on a microscopic scale?
We're good at that. You know, we humans like to do associations, and
yeah.
You often hear that, hey, our solar system, planets going around the sun, isn't that just like electrons going around the heart of an atom? But the problem is one of scale, because atoms, relative to the size and distances of their components, atoms are 10,000 times emptier than solar systems. So the scale doesn't work. The real space in the small world is much emptier than in the large universe, and the large universe is pretty darn empty. Hey, I just recently resurrected this idea. If Earth is a dust mote that you cannot see, let's make a scale model where Earth is just a little larger than a germ.
Okay.
A dot you can't see. The sun then on that scale is 1 inch away, and the sun is the dot, you could see it then, the period at the end of a sentence in a book.
Mm-hmm.
So if the sun is a period at the end of the sentence,
the
nearest star is another period, another dot, 4 miles away.
4 miles away. That's pretty good. Thank you.
Wow.
And off we go. That was nice. Thanks, Sheldon. We appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, that was a good way to start the show. So
yeah.
we're a molecule possibly on a pastrami sandwich in a deli.
No, I didn't say pastrami sandwich.
No.
But that would be what I would order, right? That's what
Is
you
that
would
what
order.
You would order?
Wouldn't you? In a deli?
Well, maybe in this universe. We'll see. All right, Zach, let's take a break. 1-800-348-2551. We'll fire up the lava lamps. It's going to be one of those days. 1-800-348-2551. Get your calls in with Mr. Berman.
Support comes from Molly Cantor Pottery, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Reception during the Shelburne Falls Art Walk, September 14th, 4 to 8 p.m. New student work and music by Jeremy Starpoli. MollyCantor.com. Healthy Living Market and Cafe, celebrating their grand opening event under the Big Top Tent at the Wilton Mall, September 15th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. with food, live music, and activities for kids. HealthyLivingMarket.com. Dr. Joseph Cohen, optometrist, eye examination, classic eyewear, contact lens fitting in historic Uptown Kingston, participating with MVP, Empire, Davis, VSP, Medicare, and other insurances. CohenOptometry.com. Saratoga and North Creek Railway announcing Teddy Roosevelt Rides Again Weekend Festival. Food activities and live entertainment for children and adults next weekend, September 14th and 15th. SNCRR.com. And Anderson Center for Autism, Statsburg, New York, supporting individuals and families addressing autism spectrum disorder. AndersonCenterForAutism.org.
Say, did you know the fun drive is coming on Monday the 23rd? Yes. A sullen nod of resignation from Zach the engineer. Yeah, well, you'll have to work too, Zach. And boy, we'd love it if you could chip in early at our website, wamc.org. It is the lockbox, and if you feed it now, indeed, everything will count on day one. We're at about $100,000, which is a good day of a fun drive we've already knocked off, and we have a couple of weeks to go. So if you want to make a pledge now, it all counts on day one, wamc.org. Look for the image of the lockbox and make your secure online pledge. We'll shorten this drive, by golly. Bob Berman is our guest, 1-800-348-2551. We talk astronomy, and NASA will be hosting a little symposium or a conference, if you will, on asteroids. What's the deal with that?
Right, and I just realized that astronomy and pastrami sound alike. Uh-huh. I think that's why we were thinking of it.
Indeed.
So NASA, at the end of this month, is going to have an asteroid conference for all the UFO people. You know, we were talking about question about flashes across the sky.
Well, how does an asteroid correspond with a UFO?
Well, anything that a person can't identify
yeah.
is automatically a UFO.
Correct.
So people who say, do you believe in UFOs? Well, of course you believe in them, because anything you see in the sky and you don't know what it is, it's
sure.
a UFO.
Okay, agreed.
So at the end of the month, NASA's going to hold this big conference. What they did, Ray, is they threw open in June, they said, we need suggestions about how we could maybe deflect an asteroid if it came near Earth, how we could prevent a threat from a near-Earth object.
Right.
And secondly, we'd like to get ideas from the public and space companies, people in the aerotech industry, which asteroids might be most practical to visit.
Yeah.
And how we get public awareness about these threats. And they've got 400 suggestions just since June. And just the other day, they selected 96 of them to consider or act upon. So they're going to hold a conference at the end of the month where people from all the different aerospace companies are going to see if they can put them into actual practice and figure out what we are going to do with these pesky thousands of rocks, some of which come close to us. We saw what happened on February 15th this year in Russia, where 1,000 people were injured by a little chunk of an asteroid that came too low.
And that had nothing to do with the asteroid that, the big one that was passing by.
Isn't that something?
So you say it had nothing to do.
Well, they came from two different directions. But here we have the closest asteroid in years to pass by Earth, and on that same day, we have something that, of course, came closer, came right through the atmosphere, blew up, knocked out glass and windows, and injured 1,000
yeah.
people. Prior to that, nobody had been injured, unless you count Ann Hodges of Sylacauga, Alabama, who in 1953 had a meteor come through her roof,
yeah.
strike a radio, bounce off it, and injure her on her upper thigh.
The dinosaurs, of course, would have something to say about that.
They were injured, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, Didn't go well for them.
Nope, but, you know, being a warm-blooded, we have this bias anyway. So
I mean, how much of a danger is, I mean, they don't even know how many asteroids are out there, right?
Right. There's thousands. They go from the big ones, those four big ones, Ceres, Pallas, Vesta, and Juno, and as big as 600 miles across.
Okay, and that would do severe damage. To put it in perspective, and by the way, the number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. To put it in perspective, How big do they think the meteor that hit 65 million years ago, or the asteroid that hit 65 million years ago, how big do they suspect that was?
If I remember right, and my memory could be faulty, it was half a mile.
Okay.
It certainly made a crater large enough, dozens of miles across, just half of it on Yucatan, but most of it off the Yucatan coast.
In the Gulf of Mexico.
In Chicxulub, yep. And we date that because of the worldwide deposition layer of iridium and osmium. These are among the things we're thinking of mining in an asteroid because they're common in asteroids. They're rare on Earth.
Why are they common in asteroids and rare here?
Obviously, when the asteroids first formed or they failed to form a larger planet, this was the heavier material, the volatiles that make up parts of every planet, especially the lighter planets from Jupiter on outward. These are the things that would have made up the core of another planet after the volatiles were sent streaming outward from the sun, from the early sunlight, and they failed to form. They failed to coalesce into a new planet. So, interestingly enough, we have a worldwide layer, thin little layer of iridium and osmium all around the world laid down 65 million years ago.
Is it an even layer?
I think so, yeah. And this is what made Luis and Walter Alvarez, this was the absolute key that unlocked what fate befell the dinosaurs, since this is exactly the time when they expired.
And the 600-mile across asteroids would be easy to track, right? It's the smaller ones that are... we don't know about, right?
Exactly, yeah. Some of the little ones are just a few meters across. You know, you get 10, 20, 30 yards across. We don't see them unless they're really close.
And that's not really a big deal unless you're a geosynchronous satellite or something.
And then you
may be in trouble.
That's right. Well, 60,000 tons is the mass that really concerns you the most, because if an object is that heavy or heavier, it won't slow down. Because of our atmosphere, it'll hit Earth at full cosmic velocity. Now, cosmic velocity is 66,000 miles an hour. That's how fast Earth goes. So if you have something coming at us head on, it'll be double that speed. And since impact damage or kinetic energy is equal to your weight times the speed squared.
Okay.
The speed is very, very important, and the speed is super fast if an object is that heavy. So it's not just that it has more mass, it's that it's not going to slow down. Whereas the lighter ones, the garden variety meteorites that people have found, we found 11 in New York State's history, slow down so that they all hit the ground. And people don't know this. Every meteor that comes in, thunk, comes in at only about 250 miles an hour. So that's the speed they'll hit a roof or a lawn.
Mm.
And there have been a number of people that thunked into a lawn just as they were passing by or standing there. We've had a number of houses, one in Chicago a few years ago, of course, in Wethersfield, Connecticut, twice.
Which is odd, right?
Yeah, two in the same town.
Yeah.
And these were all, they managed to come through a roof because of 250 miles an hour, a several pound, in this case it was an 8-pound object, irony object, will make it through a roof. Will sometimes make it through one more floor, but usually not. And then that's it. It won't keep going.
Mm.
And then it'll thunk around for a while, and that's the end. And that's why what happened to Ann Hodges in Alabama, what's happened around here over and over again, is the penetration of your roof and not much else. And then suddenly there's this mad, crazy rattling around as an object comes in, bounces from the floor to the ceiling a few times, and that's it.
All right, let's go to the phones. Mike in Adams, Mass., you're on with Bob Berman.
Hi. I was just curious. I'm going to kind of ask my question and I'll hang up the phone. But I recently was talking to my children about the solar system and that kind of stuff. And we were talking about all the different planets. And Pluto, I've heard, obviously, that it's not a planet anymore, but it was when I was a kid. So I guess I was hoping that you might be able to explain to me so that I can explain it to my six-year-old why it's not a planet anymore. Mm-hmm. So that's my question. I'm going to hang up and listen for your answer.
All right, Mike, thanks.
Yeah, people hate this. I just got an email from one of the readers in Astronomy Magazine. He went on and on about Pluto not being a planet and how it was just a few members of the IAU, the International Astronomical Union, who made the decision for everybody. Now the whole world has to live with this planet being demoted. And I just say thanks for your letter. Appreciate you that you wrote. People are really bothered by that. And I'm trying to figure out why. One reason may be that we only had nine planets, and people don't generally know a lot of astronomy. Like, if you ask most people, what's the distance to the moon? What's the diameter of the sun?
Yeah.
People don't know that. But everybody could name all the planets. There were only nine of them. And there was Pluto. Plus, there's the Disney connection, the dog. You know, it was a cute kind of thing. But we had to demote it. That's what people don't accept. It had to go.
And the reason for that is?
Well, first, we've known for about 25 years that it's different from the other planets, but we could have lived with that. It's much smaller. It's only 1,400 miles in diameter. The moon is 2160, so it's only two-thirds the size of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
It has this crazy orbit. It's inclined 17 degrees from the plane of the solar system.
Yeah.
It's eccentric. It comes closer and farther away. It's not a round orbit. We could have lived with it. Then we found there were two of them. Pluto's not a single object. It's a double something. We call it Pluto and Charon.
Yeah.
Well, you could say it's Pluto and its moon, but the two of them go around. They both move. They're going around their common center of gravity. There's only a diameter difference of 2 to 1. They're like two objects. Okay, we could have lived with that too.
All right.
Then came the clincher. This is what killed Pluto. We started finding more of them, right in Pluto's area, with names like Quarwar and Sedna and Eris. Eris was a particularly bad one, so far as Pluto was concerned, because Eris is heavier than Pluto. It's bigger than Pluto.
Okay.
So, obviously, if Pluto's going to remain a planet, these things have to be planets, and we're going to have dozens of planets, 40 planets, 60 planets, eventually hundreds of planets. And all the kids who had posters like we did when we were kids and had planet posters, you have to memorize hundreds of little posters. But planets, and all of them are these little pieces of garbage compared to these eight big ones. You had eight big ones, the classic ones that are all similar. They're all round. They all go around the same plane. They're all roundish orbits. And then you have all these little tiny, little riffraff, odd pieces of flotsam and jetsam that are huddled together that are very different from the others. So you know what makes more sense is you have two classes of planets. You keep the first eight as planets, and the others you put in a separate bin. And so we call those dwarf planets, and there's nothing wrong with doing that.
All right, fair enough. Grace in Sheffield, you're on with Bob Berman. Hello?
Hello?
Testing. 1, 2, 3. Grace, you there?
Yes, hi. Hello?
Go ahead, you're on.
Okay. A couple days ago, on television, they were talking about the Brocken inspectors, and so I Googled it, and they're pretty cool. And my question is, is the halo there anyway, or do you sort of need that shadow in order to make the halo? And then, the other question is, can you have the shadow without the halo?
What's a Brocken inspector, Bob?
The Brocken inspector, or specter of the Brocken, is something that you used to... Never had a question about this. I'm really glad I know this subject, because otherwise I'd have to make up stuff a lot.
That's what I do.
They used to see it from mountaintops in Switzerland and Germany, and you can only see it from above looking down.
Okay.
And so there'd be a shadow cast on clouds below you. In other words, when you're above an overcast, when you're on a tall mountain and there's fog or clouds below you, there'd be a shadow cast by the early sun, and there would be the shadow of yourself, by the way, with your head having a series of concentric colored rings around it, often called the glory. Well, these days you can see it from a plane, and you do see it from a plane. If you're on the side of the commercial jet away from the sun, you'll see the shadow of the jet, and then you'll see a series of colorful rings around it called the glory. Do you ever see that, by the way? Don't jump up and yell, "I see the glory," because that's not really cool anymore.
And if you're on a plane, there, you know, the marshals will take you to the
back.
They
will.
It's just not a good idea.
But so we see it. So in the old days, it was very, very common. Now in the age of aviation, people see this all the time. And so I think your question is whether you need to see the shadow, or do you just see those series of circles that are part of the specter, that's the glory part of the specter. And
my question is, does that halo need the shadow in the middle?
Okay.
Well, yeah, because here's the big exception. You can be so far, especially when you're in a plane and you're looking at the plane shadow, that the umbral shadow has converged and then diverged, and you no longer see the shadow. You only see the glory part of it. So that's the answer to your question. You don't have to see the shadow if you're far enough away from the surface that it's being cast on. That is the top of the clouds. You'll only see the colored rings, the glory. You will not see the shadow.
Grace, thanks a lot. Fantastic. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman is our guest. Steve in Bolton is up. Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question, actually. You're talking about asteroids and meteors, about the Perseids.
Yeah.
And I think it was probably the first night. The third night wasn't so good, but the first two nights were pretty good here in Bolton. And there was a distinct meteor that was traveling in the wrong direction. I was wondering if anyone noticed it. It was one of the brighter ones, and it looked like it was going south to north. And just wondering if anybody reported anything falling at, like, Crown Point or something.
Right. No, not falling, because every meteor you see is 60 miles away. And some of them are as much as 80 miles away. None are closer, even when they look close, simply because meteors stop glowing when they get below that height. They cool down enough so that they're no longer luminescent. And sometimes when they're heading downward, they look like they're disappearing behind your neighbor's trees, and people always say, hey, it looked like it came down in the next yard or the next town. No, it's never the case. It's way, way, way up high. And I saw that one, too. I think the same one you're talking about. We had a big group at Mohonk Mountain House, and we had about 350 people all gathered in the baseball field on towels in the grass. We were looking up at the sky, and we saw some great Perseids on Sunday night. And there was at least one that was brilliant that was heading the wrong way, and that's a sporadic meteor. Every night there's about six an hour that are not part of the shower, and that was a nice bright one that was not part of the shower. So that was very observant and perceptive of you to catch it and to recognize it as a non-Perseid. That's very cool.
Oh, interesting.
Well, thank you.
Well, thanks, Steve. We appreciate the call. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman is our guest. It's the astronomy show for this month. And we go over to Dan in Saratoga. Dan, you're up.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Interesting show. I had a couple questions. One involving the moon, mostly. My question was, what is the distance to the moon from Earth? And it made me thinking of it because you just brought it up just recently, that most people don't know the distance. Is it 237,000, and does that number change during different times of the year? And another question after you're done.
Let's go. You hang in there, Dan.
Well, yes, the distance is listed very differently depending upon, and usually they don't qualify it, so you don't really know how they're listing it. It's usually listed as center of Earth to center to the moon, not the nearest surface to the nearest surface. So when it's listed center to center, it's going to be a greater distance, obviously, than the closest point to Earth, because we have a 2,000-mile, the moon has a 1,000-mile radius. And we have a 4,000-mile radius, so that's going to add 5,000 to the whole thing. Yeah, 236, 237, 238,000 are often listed as center-to-center distance. And it changes because the moon's orbit is not just an ellipse, but its shape keeps changing. So that sometimes the moon has a rounder orbit, sometimes it has a more eccentric orbit. And depending upon its shape at the moment, ATM, you're going to have a different distance. That's why, you know, there are times when you'll hear it said or written, this is the closest full moon of the year, and it really is, because that happens to be a time when the orbit is allows it to come close.
And what makes the moon appear so close and low to the surface, our surface, and as, you know, the night goes on, it rises, but what makes it seem so close?
This is the famous moon illusion. The moon illusion applies even to constellations. If you see Orion or the Big Dipper when it's low, it looks enormous, and these things look much smaller when it's higher up. Two causes. One, the sky is so big. I mean, obviously, we have 180 degrees from horizon to horizon, that something as little tiny as the moon, the moon's only a half a degree wide, it means the moon is only 101 360th of the sky. Mm. And that's tiny. So when it's high up, you see that tininess. Whereas when the moon is low, now you see it against distant, like church steeples or treetops in the next town, and it gives it some psychological size to it when we see earthly objects juxtaposed against it. And finally, there is a lifelong perception that things at the horizon are really larger than they seem, because we know that something on the horizon is really far away, and so we compensate. We know that, well, that's really larger than it looks. So when we see the moon low in the sky, we do that, and we know, wow, the moon must be really big in order to look that size, half a degree when it's that low. So all of that produces the illusion, which you can make go away by viewing the moon through a paper towel holder, an empty paper towel holder. And then if you look at the moon when it's low or when it's high, it looks the same size, as long as you take away the sky or take away the surrounding earthly objects.
So there's no effect of any lens-like effect that when you're looking at the horizon, you're looking through denser air for a longer distance?
Well, you're quite right. That makes it more orange or red, and it makes the moon's image go higher up. It refracts it by its own width, actually, on the horizon. The moon is one moon width higher than it really is, thanks to refraction, but it doesn't make it any larger.
Okay. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. We got to take a break.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest, and we hit the home stretch next.
Support comes from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting An American in Venice, James McNeil Whistler and His Legacy, with etchings by Whistler, John Mayern, and more. ArkellMuseum.org. New York Electric Motor Service, Glens Falls, New York, specializing in electrical and mechanical apparatus sales and service, a subsidiary of Applied Dynamics, NewYorkElectricMotorService.com. The Alternative Baker, Rosendale, artisan all-butter baked goods made from scratch, handcrafted lemon velvet cakes and egg sandwiches daily, where taste is everything, LemonCakes.com. The Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, celebrating 30 years of educating children and striving to inspire a lifelong love of learning, WaldorfSaratoga.org. And Lori Stilwell, CPA PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond. StilwellCPA.com.
One 800 348 2551 is our telephone number, and Bob Berman is our guest. And you know, sometimes on this show we get into sort of the beginning of it all, and what's it all mean, and what's it all about, Alfie. And you know, the universe, we don't know what the universe is. And one thing that I always found interesting from a program we did several months ago, and I still can't wrap my head around it, was some noted researchers who you've been in contact with who talked about the fact that there's evidence now that we know we can see literally 0% of the universe. Do I have that right?
Yes.
And how could that possibly? I can look at the universe. That's got to be a percentage, yes?
The problem is that if the universe is infinite, which more and more cosmologists believe, this is based on real stuff. This isn't just make-believe. There's a lot that's speculation, as you know, Ray, but we're comparing baryonic matter to dark matter. We're looking at the Hubble constant, how the universe is expanding. We're watching baryonic acoustic oscillations, and that is sound from the early universe, but mostly the flat topology of space,
right,
which was just refined last year from a team at Berkeley that looked at 900,000 galaxies and found that space is flat. Light travels in perfectly straight lines as far as we can see. So that shows us, at minimum, that the universe is much, much, much larger than we thought. But many cosmologists are saying if it's perfectly flat out to those distances, it's probably infinite. So now you have a whole different can of worms. Because an infinite universe would contain an infinite number of galaxies. If there's a homogeneity that we see here that continues on, that's a big if, but if that's the case, it would mean the Big Bang was just a local event in the hood.
Yeah.
Just like something that happened locally. It would mean the observable universe, everything we could ever see, which has a radius of 46 billion light years.
Yeah.
Represents 0% of the whole. Now, why? How could it be 0%?
Yeah.
Because any fraction of infinity is zero.
All right.
So it would mean that if the universe is infinite, all we can see is 0%. Now, where do we go with that? When your sample size is 0%, how much credence can you give to your data? And we have increasing numbers of physicists who are saying that the data is so small at this point that all the stuff we're saying about, oh, the universe is this and that, here's the future, was it born, was it not? We've never known what came before the Big Bang anyway. But now if the Big Bang is just a local event and there may be other Big Bangs at different stages, it really means that it's a the whole thing is one big question mark.
Wow.
And you're back to almost the metaphysical or religious views that people had. They're just as valid as today's cosmology. But you're never going to hear this, of course, on the cosmology TV shows.
No.
When Morgan Freeman, who, of course, narrates everything in life.
he does. You're right.
He does.
Yeah.
And narrates the latest cosmology shows. What you should do is say, yeah, right. Maybe and maybe not. And it's probably a maybe not.
But if we can see 46 billion light years and it's 0% of that, then in fact, all of time and space is an illusion? Is that where we're at now?
Well, I think time is an illusion anyway. And space, actually, there's good reason why space doesn't exist also.
Terrific. Let's go to the phones and Cindy in Wales. Cindy, you're on.
Oh, hi. I have a question that no one's been able to give me an answer on. Recently, I was camping with my husband on a Boston Harbor island, and our campsite was facing west, looking toward the Boston skyline. We watched the sunset around 7:30, and then the moon came out. It was a quarter full, and I think it was waxing at that point, and it was pretty yellow. And then probably within a period of 2 hours, the moon appeared to be setting as well and got very orange and went below the horizon and looked like it had set. And I've never seen anything like that where the sun set and the moon looked as if it was setting in such a short period of time. And I wondered if there was an explanation for that.
Well, sure. This is as reliable as the tides. And what this just simply means is when the sunset, at the moment of sunset, a crescent moon will be hanging low in the west. A half moon, that is the first quarter moon, the one that's lit up on the right, mm-hmm. will be at its highest point in the sky, due south. A gibbous moon, that is a football-shaped moon, will be between the east and the south. This is a fat moon. And a full moon, that is at the moment of sunset, will just be rising because the full moon is always opposite the sun. So when the sun mm-hmm. is setting, the full moon is rising.
Huh.
Now, what will happen after that? You let the hours pass. A crescent moon is going to set soon, within a matter of a couple hours.
Yeah.
The half moon will always set around midnight. That is because it's a quarter of the way around the sky from when the sun set. It'll set at midnight. That gibbous moon will set sometime between midnight and dawn. And a full moon will set at dawn because, remember, again, it's opposite mm-hmm. the sun. So when the sun okay. is rising, the full moon is setting. And this is the absolute reliable sequence. Can't get away from it.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That explains it totally, then.
Sure thing.
Thanks a lot.
Cindy, thank you. Let's go to James Monroe. No, it's James in Monroe. How are you doing?
Okay. I was just, I think about this a lot, and I heard a lot of your callers calling before about the micro-macroism, about the difference between the universe and a molecule and all that. And that's good thought, but that's all perception. Like, whose religion is the right religion? Whose tree is in whose yard? We ought to have some kind of a connection here with the internet or something where we can all talk and exchange ideas, because this planet is part of the universe, and we can't protect it from the universe. We have to move on, and instead of spending so much time and effort in perception actually do things?
Well, you said it. I mean, that's your venue, right? You did it.
Yep, not much to add to that.
Yeah, thanks,
and
James.
We could start right now. We'll start doing stuff.
All right, let's do some stuff. Gail in Adams, you're up. Gail.
Hi. My question is, what is the significance of the fact that Higgs boson was discovered? I mean, does it have mass, that it exists, the fact that it exists? What significance is there to that?
Well, the big thing, and that's what CERN was almost dedicated to, is trying to find the Higgs, which they apparently have done,
yeah.
Is that the standard model of particle physics actually predicted all the quarks before all six quarks were predicted.
It required it, right?
Yeah, it required it because this is what made sense mathematically, and this is what worked. What did not work are the masses of all the objects. We didn't know why some quarks have almost no mass and some are very heavy, heavier than a gold molecule. Why are electrons as lightweight as they are? I mean, why does a proton weigh 1,836 times more than an electron does? Why? There was no reason for it. And so the idea was that the Higgs boson is a particle whose existence or field gives mass, endows mass to the other particles. Its existence, mathematically and physically, is what provides the mass, or at least dictates how the mass should be. So it would have been very nice if this thing actually exists, and it seems to have been discovered. And it just shows that our ideas don't have to go back to the drawing board so far as the particle physics world.
Okay, so that's only a mathematical aid, let's say, in our calculations. The fact that it exists, but it, in of itself, does it have mass or does it just lend mass?
It lends mass. It's really more, I know we say the Higgs boson is a particle, but it's more of a field. In fact, we're starting to think of lightweight particles as more of energy fields than actual objects with mass anyway. And I know that the Higgs boson has sometimes been called the God particle, and that's a little bit hubristic, I think. The only reason that term arose is because it endows other objects with a quality, in this case mass. They talked about it as if it had, kind of omnipotent or at least godlike qualities.
Okay, so as far as like Einstein's theory, E equals mc squared, mass times the speed of light squared, to go from energy to mass, the Higgs boson is part of that relationship in imparting mass to other particles?
No. E equals mc squared is true anyway. That has nothing to do with Higgs. It just means that whenever
it's energy.
Well, yes. And no, I'm not saying it's exempt from it, but this is not its specialty. Any object that has any mass at all, as you said, if you weighed the mass in grams and multiplied that by the speed of light, by the way, expressed in centimeters per second, not miles per second.
Oh, pardon me?
Centimeters per second. You didn't say miles per second. You said nothing wrong. Everything you said was right, by the way.
Okay.
Multiplied by the speed of light in centimeters per second squared, you'll have the energy in ergs. And that just simply means that something like a proton, we mentioned before, it has 1,836 times the mass of an electron. Another way of saying it is that this is how much energy is being concentrated or stored in each proton, and that if you convert one to the other, as nuclear fusion does in the sun, or atomic weapons do, you can convert that mass to energy, or in very energetic parts of the universe where there's high energy fields, particles form out of the energy flux from the energy into mass.
Okay.
So it works both ways.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
All right.
Got it. Thanks a lot.
Gail,
sure
thank you very much. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. We go to Andy in Plattsburgh. Andy, you're on.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good. Welcome.
Well, thank you. One of the things when you were talking earlier about the size of the moon on the horizon and against the sky, when I was teaching earth science, one of the things I tried to show my students that based on the golden rule of the human body ratio, that if you extend your arm fully and you put your fingers out at 90 degrees to your hand, and you look at each finger is approximately 2 degrees, as I remember it.
Yes,
and,
quite so.
So when you, just like an artist who is trying to find proportions in a painting that they're doing, by doing that, you could help people like myself or yourself who are trying to figure out what you're looking at, exactly where you're looking, by using this method of estimating angular distance, angular size, I mean.
Absolutely right. I love that you were an earth science teacher. Earth science was my favorite thing. I think the best course in school. And you're right. Each finger is about 2 degrees, or, put another way, a clenched fist held at arm's length, held vertically, measures about 10 degrees. Now, what this does is, since there's 90 degrees from the horizon to the overhead point, to the zenith, you can do things like, well, tell your position on Earth. If you can find the North Star, just by following the Big Dipper's pointer stars to Polaris, the North Star, that's always equal to your latitude. Around here, where we're at latitude 42 or 43 degrees, depending upon where you're listening from, it would mean that the North Star has to be 42 or 43 degrees up. 45 degrees is half of the distance to the zenith, of course. So if you put your clenched fist held at arm's length, held vertically, on the horizon, put the bottom on the horizon with one eye closed and piled fist on top of fist, mm-hmm. you'd find the North Star is 4.5 fists high. And the next time you're lost at sea, let's say, if you find that the North Star is high overhead, well, you're in trouble. It means you're in the cold Arctic waters. If it's near the horizon, yeah, and then you're in the happy situation of being in the tropics and things aren't so bad. So you can really tell your position on Earth just by finding Polaris and using that fist held at arm's length from you. So, and that's just one of the things you can tell. Time by, you can tell how much time you have till sunset or moonset. There's lots of things you can do with what you just mentioned, that is determining angles just by using your hand.
Right, and reminding the people that the Earth rotates at about 15 degrees per hour, that gives them the ability to predict positions of objects in the sky as well, which is kind of fun for them.
Exactly. You're on a camping trip. You want to know how much moonlight you have left. You just look at the moon and the distance to the horizon. Of course, it doesn't set straight down unless you're in the tropics, but figure down and to the right, and you measure how many gaps of a clenched fist held at arm's length between the moon and the horizon. If there's three, that's 30 degrees, and then you'd remember what you just said, which is that the moon moves 15 degrees an hour. So if there's 30 degrees gap between the moon and the horizon, it means you have 2 hours left of moonlight. Or do the same thing with the sun. All these things are easy to do, and it's a connection between our lives and the universe that's sadly all too rare these days. But I'm so glad you brought this up.
Thanks. Well, have a great day.
Andy, you have a great day as well. We're just about to have a minute here, Bob. So, you know, we teased it earlier. You have this new book. You won't tell us anything about it?
People will forget, Ray.
Well, I'll forget, certainly, but you could at least tell me.
Zoom
is the title?
It's called Zoom.
What's it all about?
And the rest of the title is From Atoms and Galaxies to Blizzards and Bees, How Everything Moves. And it's not really about astronomy. It's about, well, the speed of digestion in your body and blood through your veins and winds blowing and tides and waves moving. I didn't know that waves move at 45 miles an hour, for example, or that germs can...
On average or all the time?
Almost all the time. Or that germs can cover 2 feet in an hour, the fastest germs. Or that bacteria swim 10 times faster than fish relative to their size. I mean, a lot of new things, and the stories of the people who made the discoveries through the ages. I found a lot of quirky stories.
How did you come up with this idea?
Well, I don't know how I came up with the idea, but it was about a year of research and doing it, and it'll come out this spring.
So you just came to you one day?
I honestly don't remember. I don't even remember what I did last weekend. And you're asking how that the book started. But the publisher, we had just, the Sun's Heartbeat had just come out, and they said, well, any other ideas? And I was thinking,
First thing that came to your mind, bacteria.
It's so obvious that, you know, we're living in a matrix of energy and motion where everything around us moves, is eternal. Energy never decreases in the least. How does it happen? So, I enjoyed it.
A happy time to end the program. Bob Berman, thank you. Support comes from Little Wolf Architecture, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, providing collaborative discovery and design for dwellings in the regional landscape, featuring passive house and natural home strategies, littlewolfarch.com. Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York, legal and consulting services on regulatory issues for life insurance and annuity manufacturers and distributors, currancompliance.com. The Honest Weight Food Co-op, open at their new location, 100 Watervliet Avenue, Albany, offering local and organic produce, groceries, and more, honestweight.coop. And East Heaven Hot Tubs and Paradise Spa, Northampton, Massachusetts, offering private hot tub room rentals with indoor or outdoor rooftop tubs, massage for couples and individuals, eastheaven.com for reservations. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who handled the controls. Our phones were answered by Patrick Garrett. Thanks to you for calling in. Thanks to Bob Berman and Moyers & Company tomorrow at this time. Medical Monday on Monday. Have a great weekend.